A very warm welcome to Midori House, live from Studio One here in London, with me, Andrew Tuck. Ahead in the next hour, we'll be hearing about Christine Lagarde's trip to Brazil and what it says about that country's economic performance. Also on the show, the film opening Nobody Wants to Be Invited to. We find out how Russian cinemas are refraining from showing one of the most politically charged documentaries of the year. We'll be further unwrapping the new issue of Monocle. Design editor Hugo McDonald will be with us, and we'll also be hearing from a new design company, Stellarworks, in Copenhagen. All that, and some good music too, right here in the next 60 minutes on Midori House. But first, let's get the news from around the world with Louise Bambury.
Monocle 24 News with Louise Banbury. The European Union has agreed more sanctions on Iran's officials and businesses over Tehran's nuclear programme. The sanctions will involve travel bans and freezing of assets, and the Union agreed to look at additional measures aimed at severely affecting Iran's financial system. US Treasury officials also said today they're committed to taking steps to freeze the assets of the Iranian central bank. Mark Toner from the US State Department says diplomatic pressure is the right route to take.
So you're seeing both a chorus of international condemnation as well as actions on the part of countries around the world that I think, again, reflect Iran's isolation.
Yemen's opposition said it has agreed the lineup of an interim government with outgoing President Ali Abdullah Saleh's party. The deal aims to end the struggle over the president's fate, which has brought the country close to civil war. However, progress on the deal, which was brokered by Yemen's Gulf Arab neighbours, showed no signs of ending the bloodshed. At least 12 civilians, government troops and anti-Saleh gunmen died overnight in the country's commercial capital, Taiz. A car bomb has killed 10 people and gunmen have executed 8 more in Iraq's Diyala province. The violence came as the government welcomed the US Vice President Joe Biden at a ceremony in Baghdad to mark the departure of American troops. The bomb tore apart a market in the mainly Shiite town of Khalis, 50 miles north of the capital, hours before Biden hailed the end of the war. European Central Bank President Mario Draghi warned in his first formal address to the European Parliament today that the economic outlook is worsening as a result of the euro crisis. He called for credible signals to be given to restore confidence.
What I believe our economic and monetary union needs is a new fiscal compact, a fundamental restatement of the fiscal rules together with the mutual fiscal commitments that euro area governments have made.
The UK government said it was hopeful of reaching a deal to reform public sector pensions a day after hundreds of thousands of workers walked out over the issue. Talks aimed at averting any further strikes resumed after union leaders warned more were possible if the government failed to alter reforms. Chief Secretary to the Treasury, Danny Alexander, says the talks are important.
It's the right thing to do, both for the government and for the trade unions, to carry on discussions about pensions, which was going on before the strikes, which we'd previously agreed would carry on after the strikes. It's why the timing of the strikes were so odd and so damaging.
Those are the stories the top of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Louise Bambury doesn't know her top from her bottom. Well, anyway, it's now time for the global weather with Thomas Schaffernacker.
The weather, in association with Kuoni Travel.
And the continent is very much split into two. Quiet, calm, mostly sunny weather across the Mediterranean, and at times the wind-swept and rainy northern half of Europe, and that's how it's going to remain for the next few days. Here's Friday's city forecast. London 8 Celsius, partly cloudy. Madrid 9 Celsius with showers. Hamburg at 11, rain and wind here. Prague 8 degrees and partly cloudy. And air travel is looking bumpy over the UK and across most of northern Europe. The jet stream will be at its strongest this weekend and right over Britain, so buckle up. As far as North America goes, good weather across the central and eastern states, also in Canada. The Atlantic seaboard will have sunshine all the way from Florida to New England, snow across the Rockies, and Southern California, a blast of severe Santa Ana winds. You may have heard of those before, damaging dusty winds that happen occasionally in this part of the world. Okay, Friday's city forecast. Los Angeles, 18 Celsius, breezy with sunshine. Denver, -3 degrees and snow. Chicago, +5 Celsius, partly cloudy, and in Washington, 10 Celsius and sunny. In the Asia-Pacific region, Japan, we're gearing up for some wet weather here, especially Friday and Saturday. All parts of Japan will have rain, some downpours likely, so if you're heading off to Tokyo, don't get caught out in the rainstorms. Here's a wider city forecast for the Asia-Pacific region through Friday. Bangkok, 33 degrees and sunny. Singapore, 32, sun and thunderstorms. Hong Kong, 20 Celsius and sunny. And in Tokyo, it's 8 Celsius with rain. That's it. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much for that, Thomas. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. The time's approaching 18.06 London time. In a moment, we'll be hearing from Sheena Rossiter about the IMF's Christine Lagarde's visit to Brazil. The International Monetary Fund's Managing Director, Christine Lagarde, is on her first trip to Latin America. In the past, a visit from the IMF was something for countries south of the Rio Grande to fear. Much-needed loans would only be handed over once painful economic reforms had been achieved. But things have changed. Many Latin American economies are booming, while those in Europe are the ones in need of IMF assistance. Sheena Rossiter is in Sao Paulo and has been covering Ms. Lagarde's visit. A little earlier, our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, spoke to her. He began by asking her how times had changed.
Yes, this is definitely a historic turnaround. The IMF has never been popular in Latin America before, having demanded austerity cuts in exchange for loans. And this time around, Christine Lagarde, she's already stopped both in Peru and Mexico, and she wanted to make it quite clear that Italy and Spain have not sought help from Latin America, have not sought help from the IMF. But this is still significant because now she's trying to drum up support from the emerging world in order to get more funding for Europe. And now I think this kind of leaves things in an interesting situation because now countries like Brazil, Peru, and Mexico, they have more and greater negotiating power with the IMF, something that they tried to get back in May when the IMF was looking for a new managing director after Dominique Strauss-Kahn was forced to step down. So I think they can use that a bit of a bargaining tool now, but it is definitely showing a bit of a role reversal here.
Indeed. And one of the other things that's quite interesting is that in the past, Brazil has made it quite clear that they're not going to help bail out the Europeans. As Dilma Rousseff put it, you know, why should we invest in this fund when the Europeans aren't investing it in themselves? Do you think Christine Lagarde is going to have any luck in trying to persuade the Brazilians and other countries in Latin America to stump up a bit more cash?
Well, Europe, even though it's a bit sick right now, it still is definitely very important to Brazil. You know, now global economy, stock markets are 80% linked with globalization. You know, there's a much bigger connection. And two-thirds of Brazil's capital inflows do still come from Europe. So there definitely still is a strong relationship, and it's definitely in Brazil's interest to keep a strong relationship with Europe. But Dilma Rousseff, her point has been made quite clear that she will only be giving money to help bail out Europe if it's via the IMF. There will be no direct investment on Brazil's part.
And you know, Brazil is seen as a bit of an economic success story at the moment. You know, impressive growth rates, growing middle class. Are there still problems though in the Brazilian economy which need to be dealt with?
Definitely. This latest visit here by Christine Lagarde in Brazil actually comes one day after the central bank meeting here in Brazil, which basically resulted in a 50 basis point cut in the interest rate, but it's still incredibly high. The interest rate here in Brazil is at 11%, and it just went down from 11.5%. It's actually the highest interest among the 40 leading economies in the world. But, you know, the central bank did that because of fears over a global economic slowdown from what is happening in Europe. But there are also other problems that Brazil has. It's concerned over its low saving rate. It only has $350 billion U.S. dollars in savings, which seems quite high, but it's still substantially lower than several other economies. It an improvement from 2008 when its savings rate was only $205 billion. So if it is hit by a recession, it can deal with it stronger than it did before. But there's still concerns. And there's also concerns over inflation. Earlier this year, figures were well above 7%. That's above the ceiling rate of 6.5%, which is the highest inflation target that the central bank has here in Brazil.
Well, that was Steve Bloomfield talking to Sheena Roster in Sao Paulo and not under the Atlantic, as it might have sounded. I think it's certainly time for a song. This is Let Nothing Change You by Hua Okino. That was Let Nothing Change You by Hua Okino. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
This Christmas, why not give the gift of Monocle? A Monocle subscription spreads happiness and cheer throughout the year. Our special gift subscription is for only the most deserving recipients. The first issue comes hand-wrapped in Monocle design paper with an accompanying welcome letter which announces your gift and a personal message should you so wish. Subscribe now and we'll also send the new exclusive tote bag for 2011 with the first few issues. Our 12-month gift subscription costs £80 sterling, including magazine delivery costs to anywhere in the world. The recipient of your gift will receive 10 issues of the magazine and also 12 months access to all of our online content at monocle.com. So whether they've been naughty or nice, why not give them the gift of Monocle?
Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. You're with me, Andrew Tuck. The Russian oligarch Mikhail Khodorkovsky was jailed in 2003 for theft and money laundering. His case has attracted condemnation from the outside world because critics suggest the charges were purely political. Now, a new documentary named simply Khodorkovsky from the German-born director Cyril Touche has been released this week in Russia. But a political black cloud hangs over the event, with just three screens in Moscow being brave enough to show it. Joining us on the line now is Rina Solvichkik, a journalist in Moscow who has seen the film. Rina, welcome to the show.
Hello, welcome. Thanks.
Thank you. Could you tell me, first of all, I know you've seen the film. As a Russian watching the film, did you think it was a good film? Do you think it tells the story well of Khodorkovsky?
Yeah, I think it is a very accurate basically picture of him as a person and how he developed over the years. And yeah, I think it's a very good film.
And tell me, were you surprised that only three screens in Moscow are willing to show the film?
To be honest, I wasn't surprised, and many journalists in Russia were not surprised because many people didn't really expect something else. It was actually quite surprising that in the beginning there were some rumors about more cinemas being willing to show the film, and then they started refusing one after the other. So what was a surprise was that actually in the beginning there was some interest and some willingness, and also that in the end now three cinemas are actually showing the movie.
And
that's more of a surprise.
Who do you think will go and see this film? Is it a film really aimed at converts already? Do you think a wider public will go and see it? Is it just really for Khodorkovsky's supporters?
I mean, not necessarily Khodorkovsky's supporters as such, but I guess people who are quite critical of the current government. I mean, that's a general issue in Russia, that basically critical films and critical articles and things like that only reach people who are sort of not in favor of the regime already. The opposition is like a bubble here. It kind of feeds itself in a way.
And just to give me a little bit of an insight into the kind of places that would show a film like this, would it be art centers? Would it be places that were known to have political affiliations that were opposed to Medvedev and Putin?
Not necessarily. I mean, there's just one cinema, one kind of very good quality, but big cinema, Eldar, which is showing the movie. And there are actually five screenings a day right now. So, and it's a very big cinema. But then, yeah, there are two art galleries showing the movie as well, and they are more like underground places for people who are critical and sort of in the art scene already.
Now, as outsiders watching the Russia, people often feel that actually if you showed a film like this, there may be kind of problems for you later on. Or even if you went to see a film like this, we've seen, you know, actions, demonstrations stopping such events before. Has there been much criticism of the places that have been willing to show the film? And what's been the official kind of media reaction to the documentary?
I don't think there is a real threat. I mean, the media reaction was very vivid. So basically all the big media was talking about the movie. And also, in a sense, the reason why the film is not shown is more, basically, I mean, that's what specialists say anyways, that it's more of a self-censorship. People are more afraid than that there is actually a threat there. I mean, yeah, most specialists say that if they showed the movie, I mean, if more cinemas showed the movie, government didn't actually do anything. It's not, I mean, because they know it will only reach a very small number of people who are critical of the government in any way, but the government does not rely on them, basically. So it wouldn't be a big issue, in a sense.
Now, the actual case comes back into the spotlight every now and then. But how much do kind of ordinary Russians kind of think about this story? And what's his reputation really in Russia now, Khodorkovsky?
I guess it's very mixed. I don't think that the ordinary Russian thinks about these kind of issues very much, because people here are more concerned with everyday survival, to be honest. But generally, I think it's very mixed. I think on the one hand, people still consider him to be like on the bad side because he's an oligarch. But on the other hand, people, I mean, especially people who are, I mean, intellectuals and people who read and think a lot, they also see him now as a figure who posed Putin and who's rather brave and now changed also during time in prison, because I mean letters by Khodorkovsky are published and they are really like reflective and critical also of his deeds in the 90s. So yeah,
and
so I think it's very mixed. But
just out of interest, when you go to the cinema in Moscow, are you getting really many kind of Russian films showing in Russia in Moscow, or is it do you get to see lots of films from the US, from other European countries?
It's both. I mean, there is a lot of homegrown cinema and quite good movies, actually. They usually, or often these days, deal with issues that are not sort of contemporary importance, at least politically. But they are very good movies. But they're also showing, of course, the Hollywood sort of program. So it's both. It's okay. Very open.
Good. Well, we're interested to see how this unfolds over the coming days, so we may catch up with you again later. But for now, thank you very much for joining us, Rina. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from London. And now we're going to go over for a song. This is The Look by Metronomy. That was The Look by Metronomy. It's approaching the bottom of the hour here on Midori House on Monocle 24. Later in the show, we'll be flicking through the latest issue of Monocle magazine with our very own design editor, Hugo MacDonald. But first, here's the news headlines with Louise Bambury.
The European Union has agreed more sanctions on Iran's officials and businesses over Tehran's nuclear programme. US Treasury officials also said today they're committed to taking steps to freeze the assets of the Iranian Central Bank. Yemen's opposition has agreed the lineup of an interim government with outgoing President Ali Abdullah Saleh's party. Meanwhile, at least 12 people were killed overnight in the country's commercial capital, Taiz. A car bomb killed 10 people and gunmen executed 8 more in Iraq's Diyala province. The violence came as the government hosted US Vice President Joe Biden at a ceremony in Baghdad to mark the departure of American troops. The new head of the European Central Bank said today it stood ready to act more aggressively to fight Europe's debt crisis if political leaders agree next week on much tighter budget controls in the Eurozone. The International Monetary Fund said it's likely to cut its growth forecast in January when it updates its world economic projections. And US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said the US will support more aid for Burma and consider installing an ambassador after an absence of some 2 decades. Those are the headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Louise. You're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck. This week we've been diving between the covers of our bumper December-January issue of Monocle. Today we'd head to the design section, and I'm joined now by our very own design editor, Hugo McDonald, who's here to talk to us about a new design company, Stellarworks. The company merges very different design cultures, Italian, Danish and Japanese, and the furniture collections are made in China. Rather than sweatshop production, though, the aim is to promote quality Chinese craft, showing a different side to the much maligned Chinese design industry. We're also joined on the line from Copenhagen by the founder of Stellarworks, Thomas Licker. Hugo, thanks for joining us. And just quickly before we go over to Thomas, it is much maligned, isn't it? Kind of made in Japan, made in China. You know, that we're very unsure when we turn over a product and we see made in China. We have so many assumptions about what that means.
No, you're quite right. I think everybody, excuse me, assumes that anything that comes out of China is made under horrific working conditions. And that seems to be the majority of the press that comes from the huge factories, the technology factories, the T-shirt factories. But there is another side to it. China has a very great, rich design heritage of its own, which which has sort of struggled to come to the fore. And this is exactly what Stellarworks, this new company, is seeking to promote.
Well, I know we have Thomas on the line, so perhaps you'd like to throw him a question or two.
Hello, Thomas.
Hello.
How are you?
Good.
You? Thank you very much for joining us. I'm very well too. And you are, I mean, well, in the pages of the magazine, we tell the story of Stellarworks and how it came into being. But it's quite an unlikely combination of different design cultures. And perhaps you could start by telling us how the project kicked off.
Well, initially it started up by the chairman of Furniture Labo, the Shanghai-based company factory. Yuichiro Hori, the chairman, through a mutual friend of ours, actually put us together, and Yuichiro came to Denmark to discuss various possibilities, mostly regarding his passion for Danish design, Scandinavian design tradition. He wanted to do kind of like a vintage collection. So he flew up to Denmark from Shanghai, and we spent a day together and discussed the possibilities. He introduced his factory and all the facilities, everything they could do, the craftsmanship, the qualities, and I was very intrigued by the opportunities. So very early, actually after that meeting, I was like, this has to be bigger than just doing a vintage Danish vintage collection. This has to be, there's so much more to do and so much more potential. So that is initially how it started up. And then with my design, my partner in the company of OEO, Amory Buhmann, we went to Shanghai and visited the factory, spent a week there and met the staff and
We've got some pictures of the factory here, and it doesn't look anything like what people might imagine a factory in China looks like. It's very bright.
No.
It's very sort of good quality lighting, nice sort of signage as well. Were you a bit surprised when you visited the factory for the first time?
Actually not, because I had such a good impression. But yet again, I was. I mean, this was not really like, I never been to China before, and I also had like an image of what China is. So yes, in that sense, I was very surprised. But yes, it was it was kind of wild. I mean, they cleaned the factory four times a day and used Toyota management set systems to optimize production and quality and everything. So it was really, yeah, in that sense, not what I expected to see.
And the people who are working in the factory, many of them come from sort of traditions of furniture makers in regional China. Is that right?
Yeah, they come from all over China, and they also have, I mean, Furniture Labo has very strict training program, and also get people, when they get hired, they have to go through a training, and only, I think it's only 3 or 4% that actually pass the test, and they need to have at least 10 years of experience of woodworking. But it's both woodworking, upholstery, and leatherworks. It's kind of, it's amazing.
So the quality of the pieces that are made there are extremely high, because the other sort of accusation that gets wielded against sort of China, particularly for its design, is that things look very much like their Western counterparts, but they never stand up to sort of quality control.
Yeah, because they are actually specialized in smaller productions, so it's more like bespoke production. So actually they are kind of better handling making 300 chairs than thousands of chairs, because it's really about the quality and detailing and refinement in each piece. So that's also why the manufacturers, they do OEM manufacturing for a lot of big companies also in Europe.
Thomas, can I just quickly ask you, how important is it that the likes of you come along? Because what's interesting is they haven't done it on their own. Are they at a stage when they're trying to sell Chinese products around the world that they do need to have these international partnerships to maybe add some credibility even to the project?
Actually, I don't think it was about credibility. It was more like about the right mindset, if you can say that. Because they kind of like had the, I mean, they are an OEM manufacturer. And what I saw, this was like not just to do OEM production, because they had all the credibility and the possibilities to actually become their own brand. So that's what we actually introduced to them and said, why don't we make a brand from scratch and tapping into all your expertise, know-how, and all the people working with you, and just do it from scratch. And then that's how Stellaworks came up, was to also back to the what we found interesting from the based out of Shanghai, was also the kind of like multicultural approach, been very influenced by other cultures from centuries. So that's actually how it came up.
And Thomas, the pieces themselves are very beautiful. There's five different collections, a huge number, and they were launched in the Shanghai Furniture Expo to great critical acclaim and enormous business interest as well. Was the business interest mainly in China, or was it from sort of European and American companies as well?
No, I mean, there was a huge interest actually from all over the world. I think there was more than 40 countries actually, dealers, distributors from 40 different countries was interested in the pieces. So it was kind of overwhelming response. But Asia Pacific, of course, they were really, I mean, Thailand, Japan, China, Hong Kong, etc. But also all the way to LA, New York, Finland, Denmark, you know. So overwhelming response.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Thomas, thank you very much for joining us and telling us all about Stellaworks. You're listening to Midori House, live from London. We're going to take a song now, but Hugo's going to hang around so we can talk a little bit more about the world of design and especially our bumper issue. So this song is Phoenix. Oh, actually, it's Fences by Phoenix. That was Fences by Phoenix, and you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Now, Hugo has kindly stayed around because we want to talk a bit more about his design pages and the current issue of the magazine. And Hugo, one of the stories you lead with is soft power in the UK and the role that design can play in selling Britain around the world. Do you think that's true?
Yes, I do. I mean, we specifically wanted to look at how Britain is using, or not using, actually, is the case, maybe it's design and architecture, homegrown talent to promote itself as one of the leading cultural players in the world. I mean, London is home to some of the world's finest design and architecture schools, but students don't really stay around here. They more often go abroad, where they find commissions are a lot more fruitful.
So are you hoping that, I know that one of the things we pegged this to was the upcoming Olympics, and are you hoping that that event will help kind of put the spotlight on design as well?
Definitely. I mean, the Olympics is the key to this story in that there were a huge number of commissions, not just in the Olympic site itself, but all over London and also wider in the UK as well. And people behind these commissions, the clients, have started for the first time looking at UK homegrown talent, speaking to architects, designers, to problem solve everything from transport to infrastructure, the buildings on the Olympic site, buildings where people are going to be housed, what happens to the site afterwards. It's created a huge opportunity that hasn't really been in the UK for decades. And so it's an opportunity for Britain to actually show to the rest of the world not just its sporting prowess, but also its architecture and design talent.
So for you, do you think the design legacy that you can get from an event like this isn't really the stadia that get, you know, dotted around our capitals, but actually those simple things, you know, that you can change the way that the transport network runs?
Absolutely. And this is something that Britain has done very, very well, actually, in the last 2 years, or sort of 3 years since the Olympic process has sort of got underway. It's been using everything from students to the huge sort of big names that live in London, like Zaha Hadid and the many big architects who have their studios based in London, but who are far more, well, up until now, have been working a lot more abroad.
And another design success story comes from Sweden, which is you look at the what's happened to Svenx 10, this amazing store and design brand, and a very kind of subtle kind of refresh of its retail side, at least.
Subtle refresh, in fact, a doubling in space for it. It's knocked through where its old offices and storerooms were behind the former shop, and which has been there for 84 years. And it has doubled in size because it was rapidly outgrowing its space and the number of people who wanted to shop there. So,
and people who don't know the brand, what's the background to Svenx 10?
It is one of Sweden's more historic furniture companies and retail spaces. In fact, it's really sort of one of a kind in Sweden. It's the place to go if you don't know anything about Swedish design. I would send you there to get an idea of what Swedish design is all about. It has this very strong attachment to its regal history. And
there's a bit of a British connection here as well, isn't there?
Yes, there is, because it was British architects who were involved in the sort of expansion. Although looking at it, it is still very, very Swedish. It's remained very true to the design of the original store. In fact, it's far truer than the store that it's sort of the former store before it closed for refurbishment 2 years ago.
And proving that you kind of get a lot of mileage out of each of your trips up to that region. You also visited an amazing Swedish house on an island, and it seems to kind of sum up lots of things that, you know, Monocle is concerned about. Can you tell me, you know, for you as a resident, why this building kind of really appeals?
I can, absolutely. It's on an island in the Swedish archipelago, and it's just one small single-story house on the island by itself. And it's as much about the decoration of the house, which is very natural wood throughout, sort of green fabrics and things. But it's about the state of mind that you enter as you go there. You sort of leave behind everything on the shore of the mainland and you get in a boat. And it's about the quality of life that you have there, which is living surrounded by 1,000 different types of trees, very close to nature, showering outside, swimming in the sea, and sort of generally sort of putting the clock back.
Showering outside used to be called poverty, but now, no longer.
It's a hot shower.
Okay, all right. Hugo, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Monocle 24 and Midori House.
Every week, Monocle editor Andrew Tuck looks at cities around the world and the people, buildings and open spaces that make up the urban landscape. With interviews and discussions of the spaces and places we live in, The Urbanist is your very own urban audio retreat. That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 London time here on Monocle 24 and also available on our timeshift player at monocle.com and, of course, on iTunes.
We have 7 Monocle shops around the world in London, New York, Hong Kong, Beijing, Osaka, and 2 in Tokyo, where you can find a full range of Monocle products perfect for a Christmas gift for your loved ones. We're now carrying the latest in Monocle collaborations, including Drake's winter gloves and scarves, Anderson Anderson sailor sweaters, Velextra grip wallets, Todd's passport holders, and of course, the Monocle 24 Revo radio, so you can listen to us in high fidelity sound. So at home or away, drop by a Monocle shop. We'd love to show you around.
LDN TYO NYC MT4.
Now, in a moment, we're going to be talking love. But anyway, before then, we're going to play you one more song. This is You Are Made of Stone by Jed and Lucia. That was You Are Made of Stone by Jed and Lucia. And if you love that, you might like this, because this is all about love. Because before the saccharine messages about the meaning of Christmas and by extension love start hitting our screens, the London School of Economics hosted an evening lecture on the question of what love is and how we perceive what love should be. Our reporter, Amanda Brown, went along to see if a philosopher and a psychiatrist could enlighten her.
I think love is the rapture we feel for those who inspire in us the hope of an indestructible grounding for our life. Those who give us a powerful sense of being at home in the world.
There's nothing you can do that can't be done. Nothing you can sing that can't be sung. Nothing you can say but you can learn how to play the game. It's easy.
Well, no. Actually, it's quite difficult and complex, and not what we think it should be at all, according to Professor Simon May, philosopher and author of Love, A History.
We expect more out of human love than we ever did. So I'm saying because we in fact have lost religion, we've gained the religion that believes in an almighty God. We've gained love as our alternative religion. And we've modelled love, and this is the problem, not that we value it so high, the problem is we've modelled love on how God was once said to love us. And we aren't gods, so we ain't going to achieve what God is alleged to be able to achieve.
So we're looking from each other for certain types of love that God traditionally should have provided.
Yes, I mean, God was traditionally conceived as loving, firstly, unconditionally, second, eternally, thirdly, selflessly, and so on. And these attributes of divine love have got imposed, as it were, taken on into human love. And we now, in our daily relationship, say, if you'd loved me unconditionally, you wouldn't have done X, Y, and Z. And so we are, I think, burdening them with impossible expectations.
And I always take this out and reread it and show it to friends when they're getting agonized about schools and universities for their children, and to ask the question, how much of this is for the child, and how much of this is your narcissism? Yes, the perfect child.
That is Dr. David Bell, president of the British Analytic Society, who is with Professor May at the London School of Economics to support his talk on love.
Psychoanalysis brings a discourse that I would call a tragic discourse. That is, that we're all fated to be, to a certain extent, unhappy in life, and managing the unhappiness as part of life. So there are no ideal solutions. And then, as in Simon's book, love brings in its tail very quickly, doesn't it? Feelings of jealousy. And for most people, that's painful and to some extent manageable. And no relationship is without feelings of jealousy for the other things that the person has in life, which one might not share. But to some extent, we manage that. For others, jealousy can absolutely spoil the relationship because they cannot stand their loved person having any interest apart from themselves. That's what psychoanalysis would call narcissistic.
What is this thing called love?
The lecture room was stuffed to overcapacity, and late-coming students of love, young and old, had to be turned away. So what did some of those who made it in make of the lecture?
My name is Ani. As a student here, there are a lot of public lectures going on, so this topic interested me because as a 21-year-old being here in London, I found many conflicting situations with the question of love. I think the idea of that love makes us more grounded was something that I was coming to a realization to. Because they mentioned it and kind of stressed it, then I thought maybe I'm on the right track then. I mean, that is what love is all about. But the question of if it's unconscious or really is it conditional, is it unconditional? That's what I was perplexed about. And the fact that they talked about it, and it still perplexes me how it can be unconditional. But I hope to find an answer to that too in the future.
The idea of love as a grounding experience for all of us is a comforting one, but Professor May is not convinced our modern-day approach to love is as grounded as the sensation we yearn for.
I think in a sense what's really changed is the other end of the wedding, which is the divorce. And the opportunity for divorce, as it were, plays into what I was just talking about, which is the constant search for the ideal partner. Now, I'm not against the constant search for a great love, and I don't want to devalue love. I just think we should stop modelling it on how God was said to love us.
Dr. Bell believes the idealisation of love is what causes our greatest problems.
Love has become a kind of celebrity, which everyone is led to believe they might find. And the pursuit of that unrealistic love, I think, it causes us all a great deal of unhappiness, and we have to resist it. The celebrities are our new gods, and projected onto them are totally unrealistic views of them. And it's extraordinary how it continues, because most of these celebrities, we find out they're on drugs, or they've taken overdoses, or they've tried to kill themselves, or they have killed themselves. And most of them do not lead the happy lives that the glossy magazines lead us, lure us, seduce us into believing in, and cause us considerable damage.
I'm sure the ancient Greeks, Freud, Nietzsche and Klein, would largely agree that all you need is love, but defining what sort of love that is proves a little more complex.
Well, that very loved up Monocle reporter was Amanda Brown. You're listening to Monocle 24. Oh, and I thought there was going to be a little bit of a something there, but there's not. So it's straight to me, it seems. I'm being waved at through the glass. Because that's all there is for this Thursday edition of Midori House here in London. Today's show was produced by Dawn Trump. The researcher was Tom Hall, and our studio manager was Alex Fennell. We're going to be back at the same time tomorrow at 2200 hours tonight. Our colleagues will be back with the Monocle Daily. And don't forget, straight after this show, there's one of the best shows of the whole week. It's called The Urbanist. But until then, we'll be playing you out with a song. And this is Nantes by Beirut. For now, from all of us here at Monocle 24, goodbye.
It's been a long time now since I've seen